Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And this show is about evolution, not revolution, but evolution. Looking at an evolutionary agenda for the third millennium. And that's the book we're going to look at with the author, who's online, Alan Sasha Lithman. Hello, Sasha.
Hi, Peter.
Welcome to the show. Thank you for being a guest, and I'm very grateful for your book. And I think, you know, even though the book has been out for a little while, it's the book for the future.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I think it gives us a map or an understanding, help to know how to position ourselves and to perhaps rethink what our evolution is and how we're going to accomplish it in some very grounded ways and deeply understandable ways. It's so well written. You have a gift for words, beautifully flowing. I enjoyed every page of it, and I think our audience would definitely enjoy reading this book and get a lot out of it. And we're going to talk about what's in it. So to start off with, I want to ask you, so what do you have against the term Homo sapien?
Interesting starting point. Well, I just think it's an inaccurate description because sapien, you know, through its root, means wisdom, you know, and I have a very difficult time describing our species as a wisdom-based species. I think that if we're going to really look at ourselves in terms of evolutionary beings, I mean, after all, it's rather presumptuous to assume that evolution as a process has stopped with us, that we are sort of the end game of evolution, and that evolution is not continuing to proceed and develop with us and through us, just as it has through all the species that have led up to us. So if we operate from this evolutionary premise that we ourselves are still beings in an evolutionary process, transitional beings in that sense, then to declare ourselves and define ourselves as a wisdom-based species seems to be rather a contradiction in terms if we look at our present state and the world that we have co-created and find ourselves in. I mean, they're looking back even through previous ancestors and animal species, we are the first species to foul our own nest.
So, we sure have.
In that sense,
amazing.
I think we can come up with a better terminology and way of describing ourselves in terms of evolution, recognizing that perhaps it's just a bit inflated to think of ourselves at this point as yet having achieved wisdom, though that does lie, in our evolutionary future, but we have to work our way toward that. So I think it's better to begin where we are and try to get a more realistic grasp of who we are and give a more appropriate name to ourselves so that we realize where we're beginning from in order to get where we'd like to really go.
And even the end in your book, you don't come up with Homo sapien, and we'll get to that later, where this brings us. And what I like is that you actually redefine who we are now. And what is that term?
Well, I do use a series of terms here that are more intended as descriptives rather than as definitive, because I don't want to myself, become presumptuous and start proclaiming things. But it's helpful for us.
You're saying that because of this first term that you have for us,
yes.
And you don't want to fall into that trap of being that person.
Well, Thank you for helping me out of my dilemmas here, too. Because that's true, you see. We're working with interim definitions and descriptions of ourselves because we're in the middle of our own shifts. And so I found looking at where we are and looking at the past behavior of our species, what came closest to actually describing that rather than just arbitrarily coming up with a name was the fact that our behavior has been defined by ego and our orientation to a kind of egoism that's established our whole value system and value structure. And based on that, I came up with the term homo egoicus to replace, you know, this rather presumptuous, you know, assuming of homo sapiens. And using that then as a baseline, it's probably helpful to try to give a little bit more fleshing out of what that means when I say homo egoicus. I would say it like this, that evolution, if we look back through this very long tunnel, that's according to science 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang, since that moment that being burst forth into this evolutionary becoming, we can see that every stage of each part of that evolutionary unfolding has resulted in a certain status being formed. For example, if the first materialization of that evolutionary bursting into being resulted in, you know, microscopic atomic level particles, well, those particles, those atoms have been going on for 13.7 billion years following that behavior. And so the behavior of an atom means that it has an electron revolving around itself, and it holds that integrity of that atom. And one could say, even in this kind of physics, that there's a kind of egoic integrity that holds it to its form. And it's been repeating that pattern of behavior for 13.7 billion years. That's why when you try to break the atom, you see from that tiniest of material particles how much incredible energy it takes to break it and how much incredible energy is released. So that gives you an idea of how forms that are going through evolution hold to their structure. And gravity, in that sense, this gravitational pull that keeps material forms in their form and in their pattern, repeating that pattern for as long as they've existed, that for me is a physical definition or equation for egoism. In other words, egoism doesn't just start with human beings and psychological behavior. It actually can be seen as that tendency to hold to ourselves and hold to our form regardless of whether we have even outgrown that form and need to move into a next level. So human beings, as we are at our earliest stage of emergence, I feel represent a consciousness that is defined by the same egoic patterning. It's holding on to what it knows and what it is, to a point where we may have outgrown that, but nevertheless we are holding on so tightly that the fact that we are holding is going to result in our own demise. You know, so that's why I use this term egoicus, because I think humanity reached a certain point, perhaps that came to an epitome in the 1950s, where it is held so tightly to who it is and what it operates through, which is, you know, a kind of mental way of knowing, that we actually, if we continue to hold on to that, we assure ourselves of our own death, because we have created a situation that requires a next step from which we need to develop a whole new behavior and a whole new consciousness that recognizes ourselves as transitional beings rather than fixed types. So the idea of an egoic form, an ego man, you know, as defining who we've been, gives us a baseline to recognize that we need to move beyond that. And then from that kind of rigidity of form that depends upon a certain fixed patterning, the next step would be to acknowledge, well, we are not fixed. We are transitional beings. We are capable of actually redefining ourselves. And if we see that we are reaching this stage where to continue following the pattern that we've been going at is assuring our own gravitational demise, then we can claim a new direction by saying we are transitional beings. We are capable of actually mutating, of actually co-participating and co-creating a choice and a new direction for our evolution as a species.
But the trick here is to do it in a non-egoic way.
Exactly. But we have to start from where we are, so we can't leap too far ahead too quickly. And that's why I see this kind of metamorphosis in phases. So a first, you know, basic phase is to recognize that we are programmed by this kind of primitive egoism that is making all of our decisions, our economic decisions, our political decisions, our environmental decisions, that are all based on I, me, mine.
Well, also, let me just say that I have my own sense of the mentality of it, which is not only personally selfish, but it's tribally selfish as well. So we're functioning also in masses of consciousness of selfishness and of ego.
Quite true. And because ego is not something that's exclusive to any individual or any species. You know, as I was suggesting, if one goes all the way back, there is an ego in matter. And if we jump back into our present, collectives also take on egos, cultures, countries, systems. All systems are designed to retain and keep themselves. What systems till now have been designed to actually transform? So there is a primitive sense of an identity with one's thoughts, one's culture, one's value systems, one's politics, one's tribe, one's community, one's city, one's football team, you know, one's cells. All of these have that egoic imprint, and we unconsciously adopt that, and so we are locked into that system gravity at all these different levels simultaneously. That's why we're not just dealing with our own personal egos, but we're dealing with, you know, collective egos within collective egos. And the larger the collective, the older the egoic pattern. In other words, to change the patterning of a culture or a country that's hundreds, thousands of years old and is comprised of millions of people repeating those cultural and intellectual and, you know, material patterns and system patterns is much more difficult to change than an individual changing an individual pattern in one lifetime. So this is what we're coming up against when we're really trying to change things at an evolutionary scale and not just a revolutionary scale. Revolutionary scale, you know, if you look at the term, it's a revolving pattern that comes back to the point where it began. That's why we see when, you know, revolutions in our study of history, oftentimes those people who are the liberators wind up adopting the patterns of those whom they overthrew and become the future tyrants. And so, you know, we just absorb patterns that we haven't transformed.
Well, the word transformation is very important. And actually, on last week's show, we had a talk about that with Bruce Lipton, and had an understanding that reform isn't going to work; only transform will work.
Quite true, and so that's a good descriptive to make this distinction between a revolutionary change and an evolutionary shift. In an evolutionary shift, you are not just changing the outer system, you're changing the consciousness that inhabits that system. Whereas in a revolutionary change, you can overthrow the regime or the system. But if the people who inhabit that system are still operating from the same consciousness that existed before, it will wind up gravitating back into repeating the same errors, the same weaknesses, the same blind spots, and the same flaws.
So, there's been actually research about that, and showing that people who don't believe that they're going to do that, when they eventually hold power, end up being that way also.
Quite true, and that's why there is a certain humility that's critical in approaching this kind of evolutionary self-transformative process. You know, where it's a mutational process, but it's happening in incremental degrees, so we don't see it. It's not like we're going to just suddenly leap from this kind of clumsy, mixed, half-light, half-dark knowledge and behavior that we presently exhibit to some kind of illumined, self-realized being. There's all these steps in between, and to gear down, which is practically speaking what I mean by humility, we have to first recognize where we really are and where we are in our bodies, you know, because trying to jump to the top of the ladder without taking the first step is, you know, it's an exercise in self-defeatism. We will never get there. So in a way, if we really want to undertake an evolutionary transformative process and not just some kind of magical spiritual leap, then we have to work, you know, like a scientist and like an activist. We have to begin to identify, like a detective, those things in us that need to actually be physically identified so that we can transform them, so that we can actually outgrow this egoic blind spot.
And you do that in your book, and that's one of the aspects of the book that I'm so grateful for, is that you show what we need to get a handle on. You know, how are we going to move forward in what areas of reality,
right,
and what kind of shift we're going to need for it to be real enough to be a transformation.
Right, exactly. And at the same time, you know, with this humility that I'm speaking of, we have to be really practical in the best sense. In other words, if we're going to be able to evolve to subtler and higher levels of consciousness and being, we have to survive long enough to transform. So in other words, that's what I mean by gearing down. The next stage that we are looking at, in order to move through what I've called this homo egoicus phase, which has taken us to the brink, you know, of our destruction, our self-destruction, because we have, you know, kind of plastered our ego over everything. You know, we're consuming ourselves to death. We are destroying our planet, our biosphere, our ecosystem reserves, our water, our air, all of these. If you track back, you can see it's because at some level we feel separate from it, and we feel that we have permission to consume it, instead of realizing that we are it, that this life that we are in is inseparable from us. But that ego, you see, creates this artificial blind spot and separation, so that we feel like we're operating with something that really is not us. And at the point where we've come now, we have reached this brink of, destroying our own resource base, fouled our nest because of that egoic blindness.
Well, I want to come back, actually, to one thing you were talking about, and that has to do with the wholeness of everything. And where what you talk about in the book is kind of the trap of spirituality, that we can't really trust that as the answer.
Right, right. Because, spirituality itself is evolving. You see, to imagine that we could just turn to the back of the book, things and traditions and spiritual realizations that took place thousands of years ago, and have their truth and have their luminosity and have their quality, to bring change into our lives. Nevertheless, the answer doesn't lie in the back of some book. The answer lies in our ability to integrate all of these things that have their truth, but at the same time recognizing that consciousness and spirituality and questing are not a nut that we cracked once some thousands of years ago, and we just have to keep repeating that realization again and again and again. We and our bodies now are actually in a real-time evolutionary process where we have to accept, to research our own evolution as we're going. We're building
right.
the boat as we're going.
So this is why spirituality by itself is not an answer. It really needs to take into account, we need to take into account all of society's needs and the planet's needs together and move everything forward. But I want to come back to the egoicus aspect, our ego and matter, and how you talk in the book about how matter is held together by its own ego, its own needs for survival, and
right.
its gravity, and that if our consciousness can stop being so gravity-oriented and ego-oriented, perhaps that can shift the way all of matter is held as well.
Well, yeah, eventually that is the future, and this is where I'm trying to kind of phase things in a way so that at least it becomes something that people can consider. Because if it goes too far ahead, if the leap is too great, so that's why I don't start with focusing on the transformation of matter and our bodies into, a luminous cellular future. That is there, but in a phase, and that's why I refocus attention on we have to survive long enough to transform. So the first order of business, we can say, is for our species to really do what I call evolutionary triage. Triage is a medical term on the battlefield that you recognize the most serious life-threatening injuries and you tend to those first, and then you work through that to the more subtle and so using that metaphor of a triage, an evolutionary triage, we need to look as a species at what are the things that are the most life-threatening, to our survival, to our planetary survival, to our sanity, to our physical ability. Because, if the patient dies on the table, there is no question about transformation of consciousness. So that's why it's a very humbling exercise, because people who are attracted to the idea of evolution and spirituality, there's something that wants to put them very far future forward. And for me, the first sign of someone who is really willing to enter a transformational process is not to be looking you know, at great distance stages in our evolution, but willing to come back to where we actually are to make a difference here and now so that we can assure our transition and then begin, once we have cleared through our negatives and stabilized the patient, you know, so to speak, worked out the kind of environmental policies, farming policies, educational policies, you know, the things that are really basic to our survival.
Right, to create a planet that does it right.
Right, and so in a way, it's a kind of evolutionary research to identify those things that are the most critically threatening now and design policies based on that. Look at the things that are killing us and address those first, and that means placing a great deal on redefining economic values, so that we're investing in things that are really important to our future and supporting those things. Likewise, refocusing on our media and our communication system so that they're not just feeding us back into, you know, the old patterns and the old marketing
fear
of an old world and an old consciousness.
Right, a lot of fear-based programming.
Right, so that's why what you are doing and what others who are working in this kind of media, I see these things as part of a grand evolutionary transformative process that's happening at many levels in many places at the same time. And yet it's difficult, you know, to see this from a macro level because we are so inundated with the negatives and the destructives and the things that are, you know, pulling us down. And one point here that I'd like to make in the short time that we have is how detrimental we are programmed to doubt. I think in the ego, you see, there is a programming which automatically says, no, this is ridiculous. This is just all fairy tale stuff. We have to get back to really
right.
focusing on things that are practical.
Too much discouragement.
Right. So this overwhelming doubt that is there behind every effort we make. You know, we have this subconscious program that comes in to destroy it, to say, oh, we can't do that. That's silly. And so then we succumb to our fate. You know, that doubt is actually what we worship.
Well, let me come back to the book itself and understand that this is a book for that. This is a book to help us kind of get a handle on what
right.
our needs are in a way that works without ego.
Quite true.
And you know, where our priorities should start holding without getting stuck in righteousness.
Quite true. Quite true. Because one can see that even the best well-intentioned people, you know, in progressive organizations, if they can't get beyond, you know, that ego level of conflict within themselves, their organizations and their ideals will still fail. You know, you see
right.
what happens when
sure.
people get together for environmental conferences to change policies, and it winds up breaking down because the consciousness of the individuals participating hasn't kept pace with the outer change that they want to bring about.
Well, let's stop at that point because the show is almost over, and understand that this is a great gift that you're offering here to us to understand how to go about this evolution properly.
Thank you. So
let's look at the title here is An Evolutionary Agenda for the Third Millennium. You are Alan Sasha Lithman, Lithman.
Correct.
And how can people reach you?
Well, you know, I'm happy to have contact. I don't want to close off. So my email address for people who are interested is sunthesis, S-U-N-T-H-E-S-I-S, sunthesis@gmail.com. And, you know, I look forward to what comes from out of the blue.
Well, good. I want to thank you so much. You came out of the blue to me, and I really appreciate knowing you and for the great work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Peter. Likewise, you know, we're all in this together, and that's part of the secret. We need to support
right.
one another if we're going to get to where we need to go.
Great. Thank you, and thanks for being a guest on Energy Stew. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network, and I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. And thank you so much for listening.